Water, perhaps our most precious natural resource, is used and misused at a reckless rate. Our streams are fouled with an incredible assortment of waste, domestic, chemical, radioactive, so that our planet, though dominated by seas that envelop three-quarters of its surface, is rapidly becoming a thirsty world. We now wage war on other organisms, turning against them all the terrible armaments of modern chemistry, and assume a right to push whole species over the brink of extinction. As for water, one of the cruelest things about water is that what's happening to the majority of the people in the world who are poor, really poor, in the so-called developing world, Africa, Latin America, good parts of Asia, where their clean water has been taken away from them, and where they have to pay for anything like clean water. And if they can't get it, then the next thing happens. Their children are dying from poisoned water, not just from malnutrition, but from being poisoned.
You're listening to a class on political economy with Professor Doug Dowd. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, or WRFN Nashville. We continue.
The death rate, this is a United Nations statistic, 1986, it's much worse now. The death rate of children is such that 14,000 die every day from a combination of malnutrition and being poisoned. Children. You multiply that by 365 and you're up in the millions, 15 million or so. Children, those monsters, to say nothing of what their lives are like while they're alive. Not just in terms of malnutrition, in terms of, could you imagine having to trade your life as a child with one of them? No chance of education at all. A family that is desperate from morning to night to throughout the night. Probably with all kinds of ugly warfare intermittently going on over insane things caused by the fact that the Europeans went into your continent and broke up what had been what we can call tribes of people and made them into nations in which groups were cut in two and so on, and then destroyed them. I mean, in the Congo alone, there's a really terribly wonderful book by Hochschild. What's his first name?
Adam.
I know Adam. I don't know him anymore, but I used to know. Called King somebody.
King Leopold.
Yeah. The king. The Congo was not Belgians. It was his. Until after a while, this went on and on. The business people in Belgium decided they could make more money out of it. They gave him a lot of money for it and took it over as Belgium. And then time went by. World War II, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Independence comes along. Patrice Lumumba comes along. The CIA participates in his murder. And we place Mobutu on the throne, who killed himself personally, 10 million Congolese, who accumulated a fortune of over $30 billion, who was welcomed at the White House by your hero and mine, Ronald Reagan. Welcomed, who was praised by George H.W. Bush because Ronald Reagan had welcomed him. You understand? And that's just the Congo, which will never, ever, possibly recover, ever. All they can do is go from one bad situation to a worse situation to a worse situation to a worse situation. Because those people's lives have been taken away from them. And to grow up in that situation and not have water is probably a second thought. Your life is so impossible. Isn't that part of the environmental struggle? No. Yes, it certainly is. Earth, air, fire, and water, the forest, the water, the air. We talk about the air, we're talking about, among other things, global warming. But it's not just global warming. My bad voice is in part due to air. the air of Bologna, Italy, which is where I live half of every year. And if you think there's a lot of foul air in San Francisco, you're wrong. There is, but you're wrong, because it's really sweet compared with Bologna. In Bologna, you wear a mask. It doesn't do any good at all. I don't even wear one because the air is just so foul. The streets, the cars are always bumper to bumper. There's a law against people entering. Bologna has a wall around it. It's been there for 500 years. There's a wall. There are entrances, maybe half a dozen entrances. You can't go through those entrances with a car unless you have a permit. Everyone has a permit. It's this kind of a permit. The cops are all corrupted. The government is corrupted. Nobody wants to go against driving your car. The question is, why there and why everywhere else? Do people want to drive their cars bumper to bumper? I walk all the time, or bike. I beat every car. I beat every bus. Understand? It's insane. It isn't just that the leaders of our society are demented. We have been socialized to be demented ourselves, to have values, to say, this is what I want. I want this, I want that, I want the other thing. As I've said to you many times in here, Paul Baron put it in a nutshell. We are taught to want what we don't need and not to want what we do. And what we want is crap. Automobiles that don't get us anywhere, we pay for, All the television sets that we look at, fixed, hypnotized by crap. Only 90%, or maybe 95%, but crap. And our kids sit there and watch that. On the average in the United States, 6 hours a day, children watch television. What are they watching? They're not watching Sesame Street, except a few of them. And even those are watching shit. Very dangerous shit that teaches them that violence is painless. Death doesn't mean anything when somebody else is killed. That having this and having that is the way to heaven, and so on. It's just absolutely insane stuff, and so on. So I want to look now at some details of this, just to break up some of the mythology. We see ourselves as, and we say that we are this, every day. You can read it in the New York Times today if you wish, the most efficient of all societies in the world. In fact, we are probably the least efficient. If the other side of efficiency is waste, we are efficient in plant production. That is to say, when we produce an automobile or a piece of steel or something like that, until recently we were the most productive. Our productivity was the highest in the world. Now it isn't the highest in the world, but it's still pretty high. In terms of how much labor time it takes to turn out a complicated thing like an engine or anything that's complicated. A computer. We're very efficient in the plant. In the economy, we're extraordinarily inefficient. Because if you mean by efficiency getting something useful for the resources you use, for a minimum of use of labor and natural resources, then for the economy as a whole, what we get is a terrible loss of resources and labor time for what we get. Where does all of it go? Where is the waste in what I'm calling inefficiency? Where is it? Well, for one thing, just take something you're most familiar with the automobile. It was in the 1920s, as some of you know, as I've said before. It was in the 1920s that General Motors, 1923 exactly, introduced the idea of what it called planned obsolescence. So that although Ford, up till that time, was producing the same car every year with maybe a little minor change here and there, so that he said, you can have any Ford you want as long as it looks like this, in any color you want as long as it's black. And those cars are very cheap. I remember them. GM introduced in 1923 three different things. One, annual model change. Model change. Change the appearance of the thing. Two, consumer credit. GMAC, General Motors Acceptance Corporation, is their bank. That started in 1923. Three, advertising. That was the beginning. Not the beginning, but the major development that brought consumerism into being. They made the cars so that they would not last without repair for more than 3 years. I think I've told you this before. My wife's brothers have an automobile manufacturing, automobile parts manufacturing business in Italy, a big one too. They sell parts all over the world, except in the United States. As one of them told me, the producers in the United States don't want our product because we guarantee them to last for at least 10 years. Now, this is from the horse's mouth. Okay? This is not something I made up. It's my brother-in-law's business to produce things, and he doesn't ever sell them. He doesn't try to sell them in the United States because they don't want them. Now, those other 7 years are all waste for X, Y, and Z parts of the automobile. Understand? To say nothing, to take a big jump ahead in terms of what was meant by waste, by what has come to be called the throwaway product. Use it once, throw it away. Doesn't make any sense at all. It's a kind of insanity to buy things that don't work or more than once, or 1 week, or 1 month, or 1 year, or 3 years, if you can make them so they work all the time. When I was a student at Berkeley, my teacher Brady, who was an expert already in this program, 1946, 47, around in there, on waste and on efficiency, and wrote about economic planning and so on, pointed out that the automobile industry had, in fact, developed an automobile in which you would never have to add oil and which would, in effect, last forever. And indeed, as some of you will know, a car did get on the market. What was it called? The guy, a movie was made about it.
Tucker,
yeah. The car would have, it was a funny looking car, a nice car. I saw one about 2 years ago. I was biking over the Golden Gate Bridge, and there was one coming across the other way. That was 30 years or so later after the car, more than 30 years. Tucker invented this car, and what GM did was to get the banks not to allow him any credit. You understand? The GM and the rest of the automobile industry after GM. They made it so that he couldn't get credit to have his production. You understand? That's what you could call a conspiracy. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but that's a conspiracy. There is this, I'm not using words loosely, there is a need in the capitalist system to waste, because there is a need to have ever-expanding markets. At the same time, there is a need to get labor at less than its real cost. There is a need to sell products no matter what. So anything you can do, and it's being done in the computer industry now too, as you must have noticed, the models just keep changing and changing. Even though when you first began to use your computer, you thought, ooh, this is really wonderful. Now you can't make it work unless you change this or change that, change the other thing. And then you can't understand the goddamn thing. It's not done in all products, it's only done in all products where it can be done, which is most products. I'm thinking about industrial products. The kind of waste that's involved, to say only a little bit, about what we now take for granted, which is inherent waste, the inherent waste of plastic, the mountains of plastic that each of us builds every year, mountains like this. If you take all that garbage that you throw out every day, the bottles, the this is the that's the other thing, and put it all together in a little hill in your backyard, if you have a backyard, by the end of the year it would be very high. It would be a great big thing, you know. We have, I don't know, probably in your neighborhoods you probably have too, things like that blue thing in the back, garbage thing. Only we have a smaller one, but it's very big, just the same. We have a blue one, a green one, and a black one. We didn't ask for them. We get them, and we pay for them, too. I mean, our garbage bill went up like that. And they get filled, and we're Doug Dowd and family. And they get filled with garbage. A good deal of it is paper that comes to me in the mail every day. I open my mailbox, I have this much stuff, I look at it, and I stand next to the blue one where you put the paper in, and I go through them like this. And probably I've thrown away something that was important at some point, but I'll be goddamned if I'm going to open all that stuff. So this kind of thing, the waste is socioeconomic. The stuff that we are wasting is produced efficiently. You understand? There is efficiency in the plant. The economy, massive waste. As I've written in some of the stuff that some of you have seen, a very conservative estimate was made of how much of U.S. production is wasted. This was in the mid-80s. 70%. That is, it serves no useful function. It could be done differently, serving the same function. And they counted military production as non-wasteful, which is the most wasteful of all. In a sense, not only does it waste an awful lot of resources, it does an awful lot of damage when it's used, and so on. To say nothing of all the labor power that is wasted by soldiers sitting around on installations all over the world, which is the only thing that's worse than that is when they're not just sitting around, but killing somebody. Between 1946 and 1990, that is to say the years after World War II, the United States spent $9 trillion on military stuff. And most of that stuff, quite apart from the fact that it's never used, is deliberately made obsolete every year by its manufacturers, most especially those who make the planes, the submarines, and the other complicated stuff. Billions and billions and billions. That's waste. The waste. Now, I'm not, I don't think, a moralistic crackpot, but I have some ethical sense to me. To have all that waste taking place at a time when at least 4 billion people in the world are hungry and have their economies distorted and so on and so on and so on. That's absolutely unnecessary. There's mass criminality for you, really massive criminality. And part of that which is deadly is what's happening to those peoples, almost all of whom were 100 years ago, or 50 years ago even, agricultural people. And now they can't be because of the progress of agriculture. That is, because their land has been taken away from them, because agribusiness now dominates so much of it. And because not only that, but those who still are producing, whether it's fruits or vegetables or coffee or whatever, if it's also being produced in Europe or in the United States, the Europeans and the United States and the Japanese, who don't do much of this themselves, subsidize their farmers so that they can sell this stuff at a lower price than it costs, at a price that is lower than the price in the poorest country, so the poor people can't sell their stuff. And this is one of the reasons they're starving. And we're the best at this rotten game. We're much better at it than the French, the Germans, the Italians, and so on and so on, the Japanese, who might want to be just as good at it as we are if they could be. But could be is not as simple a phrase as it sounds. Could be isn't just a question of size and resources in your backyard, as we have in the United States. It also has to do with history. Our history is what made us this way. And our history is one of deliberately abandoned traditions, so that the species in this country had no memory of how it came into being and persisted through cooperation, through communal feeling, through traditions that had an ethical center of them. As I've said before in here, I am not a formally religious person, formerly or formally, ever. I didn't even know about this kind of stuff, religious thought, until I was a teenager. I didn't know about it. If I heard the words, it was as though I were hearing some foreign language. I was never confronted with it, because in my family, it wasn't that they didn't have a religion. They had two religions, combative religions. One, Jews, the other, Catholics, okay? They hated each other. But neither of them ever went to either a synagogue or a church. It was just, so there was never any discussion of this except arguments. about, and I didn't even know what they were arguing about because I was just a kid. My father happily skipped out before I was 6 years old, so I didn't have to be influenced by him. And my mother was a social Jew, very angry at discrimination against the Jews. Didn't have the foggiest idea what it was all about. I think I've told you this. She wrote to me every week when I was overseas. I pray to you for our Lord Jesus Christ every night, Douglas. Our Lord Jesus Christ, she was a Jew. I thought, well, okay, better than nothing. Anyhow, it worked. Here I am. One of the lousiest pilots ever the Air Force ever had. Here I am, still alive and kicking. But it's interesting to have a mother who's a Jew who thinks her Lord is Jesus Christ. It's off-putting if you're going to get serious. And I didn't even think about this until I got to be sort of a teenager. And I couldn't figure it out. But one thing I could figure out was that all these religious people, all of these religions, not all the people, had as one half of their existence a system of ethics. Every one of them. You can't find any organized religion in the whole world that doesn't have an ethical center to it, as well as a theological center, a theoretical center. And that's where the differences come in. There's no difference between Jews and Christians, Muslims and so on when it comes to ethics. There are lots of differences, but not when it comes down to the need for community, for being together with other people, for better and for worse. Well, those traditions, those religious traditions, were what shaped whatever kind of decent social policy emerged in Europe in the medieval and early modern eras. And they still survive. They're still breathing, so to speak. Hard breathing, because they're all capitalist. But they're still breathing. And they've been transformed from religious ethics to political ethics. Every left movement in Europe has some kind of tie to religious belief, religious ethics, every one of them. We don't. Our religions in this country are very shy of ethical principles being enunciated too often. Might get in the way of things. I don't mean it's never, I mean it's seldom. And we have eliminated the whole idea of class struggle, except when you mean the middle class, which we call everybody now who isn't poor, the middle class struggling for more credit cards. This isn't because of something rotten about us. We are all the people in the world. You can't find, or I should say it's almost impossible to find, some group in the world that doesn't have people here. You understand? We're everybody from Africa, Asia, Latin America, Alaska, the Antarctic, South, North, everywhere. We're all here. So it isn't that some biological difference between us and the rest of the world. It's a historical difference. We've been gutted out of the traditions that made humanity possible as a surviving species. So we have to, in some sense or another, reinvent people like us. Have to reinvent the notion of community, of cooperation, of brother and sisterhood. We have to invent it for ourselves because it's pissed on in every day, in every way, everywhere in this country, including kindergarten. First grade, second grade, 10th grade, high school, everything. Don't even talk about it. It's foolish stuff. I want to read you something that Toni Morrison said, and then we can go into a discussion, I hope. Toni Morrison, of course, is a novelist, a very thoughtful one. Well, let me just read you one other thing about that's economic, which is a striking statistic in terms of waste. There was an economist named David Gordon. He was the son of Robert A. Gordon, whose teaching assistant I was at Berkeley, who hated my guts. He's the one who wrote the letter to Cornell saying, this guy Doug Dowd can teach, he knows his stuff, but he's a red, he doesn't know when to keep his mouth shut. This was during the McCarthy period. This was David's father. David died about 4 or 5 years ago, because he was in a hospital and he couldn't get what he needed for some critical part. But he was a lefty. He was one of the people who was involved in the Union for Radical Political Economics, which I helped to start. And he wrote one, really, he wrote more than one thing, but he wrote one excellent book called Fat and Mean. You ought to try to get it out of the library. Fat and Mean instead of Lean. And in there he talked about the way in which capital in this country mistreats its workers and overtreats its CEOs. And one of the very important things he talks about is the waste. Between 15% and 20% of private non-farm employees, that is to say, of industrial, financial, and so on, not agricultural. Between 15% and 20% of private non-farm employees in the United States, this was 1996, work as managers and supervisors. In 1994, we spent $1.3 trillion on the salaries and benefits of non-production and supervisory workers, almost one-fifth of total gross domestic product, almost exactly the size of the revenues absorbed by the entire federal government. And what were those supervisors doing? This is in the book. Checking the workers. Keeping tabs on the workers. You know about it. Don't. So this is waste. Not only is it waste, if you were one of those workers, and I've been one of them, and you look over your shoulder and this piece of shit back there is always checking you out to see if you're, your morale does not go up. You figure, fuck them all. And you're likely as not, as I was likely as not, to do just a little bit of sabotage. Fuck things up, just a little bit, for the product. If you don't do that, there's something wrong with you. If you don't have the spirit to say, ooh, then you've been broken. And if you're broken that way, you're probably going to make up for it by trying to buy a new car or something. It's a system that has a kind of a unity to it, a kind of interdependent unity of awful things. But let me turn to Toni Morrison's thing. And this is in her book, Tar Baby, one of the older ones. She has one of the people in the book giving a soliloquy on waste. That was the sole lesson of their world, That was the sole lesson of their world. How to make waste. How to make machines that make more waste. How to make wasteful products. How to talk waste. How to study waste. How to design waste. How to cure people who were sickened by waste so they could be well enough to endure it. How to mobilize waste, legalize waste. And it would drown them one day. They would all sink into their own waste and the waste they had made of the world. And then, finally, they would know true peace and the happiness they had been looking for all along. Not bad for a novel. So let's discuss. Yes.
Back in the 1940s, Richard Buckminster Fuller invented what some people call the house of the future. And in 1946, Fortune magazine had an article about it.
The solar house.
The solar house. And it was 36 feet in diameter, and one story or one and a half. It could have been made in airplane factories without interfering with airplane production because it was made largely of aluminum. And other stuff was glass, plastic, and wood, basically. And the thing weighed 1.5 tons, not a whole lot more than the average car, compared to what the article said was 100 tons for the average house. And it wasn't terribly expensive either. And then two years later, in 1948, there was this little one-page article about what happened to the Fuller house.
Don't tell me I'm brokenhearted already.
And he couldn't get financing, and they claimed it didn't meet certain zoning requirements and things like that. Some of the ideas were ridiculous. Explanations were ridiculous. But, anybody who comes up with something really revolutionary, which is going to hurt the wallets...
Or even helpful.
...of big business, is going to be stamped out. and he could have revolutionized the housing market.
Well, yeah, but the whole thing is that the things that will be useful, but which will damage profits by, that is to say, by reducing waste, reducing consumption or something, they are not going to be capitalized. Or if they are capitalized, they're going to be something that will be bought up. And this has been done too. Companies buy up things that are good in order to keep them from getting on the market. They buy up the capital. This has been done in pharmaceuticals, it's been done in machinery, it's been done in this, that, and the other thing. I brought this clipping today, it's out of today's Times. I meant to just read it to you, and this is a parenthetical remark here. It's a headline on the energy. Environmental Protection Agency holds back report on car fuel efficiency. The environmental report had its report on car fuel efficiency showing here with these diagrams how inefficient most of our cars are. But they held back the report until the energy bill was passed. Where the energy bill doesn't do anything at all, nothing at all about putting efficiency, trying to get more efficient. Even if they had done what could be done in terms of reducing car consumption of fossil fuels by automobile, even if they'd done that, we would still be way up to here in trouble. Okay? It's just GM, mind you, about 2 weeks ago, put out a statement. I don't know why they put it out. I read it in the Times. They put out a statement saying that by the year 2030, that's 25 years from now, there will be 50% more automobiles on the earth than there are now.
Oh, God.
Well, we have at least 50% more now than we can survive with if we keep using them. But GM also said in the 1920s, when it put into its deliberate obsolescence into being, we must reproduce. We must have our cars replaced every 3 years, or the market will collapse. We will collapse, they meant. And they said that again recently. When I say recently, I mean the 1980s. Our sales must go up every year by 3%. Not our sales, GM. The automobile industry sales must go up. Because if there's, as Marx said when I read to you earlier, if there is any rule at all in the capitalist process, and there are many rules, one is there must be an accumulation of capital on and on and on and on, or the whole system will collapse. Because the accumulation of capital means increasing more and more productive capacities, okay? Increasing more and more productive capacities also means economic growth. It also means a growth of consumption, okay? And there has to be growth, 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 growth. Have you ever wondered why the principal focus, economic focus, in your lifetime has always been economic growth rather than anything else? There's another concept in economics which many economists don't even know, because economics is taught the way the system wants it to be taught, and I know that. There's another concept. It's called economic development. Economic growth is a quantitative process. Economic development is a qualitative process. I, for example, could, within an hour, I could sit down and make out a program that would be beneficial to all in this country and to the rest of the world, to all except the people who now have power. It would even be beneficial to them, but not as much as they want, because there's no end to what they want. But they would lose, first and foremost, something they don't dare want to lose, power, to make the decisions for themselves and therefore for the society. I could sit down in an hour and write that program, okay? And it would be a program of economic development. And what you would be doing is changing the structure of production to suit a changed structure of consumption, to fit a changed structure of income distribution, to be made possible only by a changed structure of power. That's all we need. In which you would be the basic key to what you would do and what you would not do would be one thing very simple. If the process, the structure of production and consumption meets human needs, their basic needs, okay. If it doesn't, Let's discuss it. Those needs are nutrition, housing, education, health care, and one other thing, opportunity, equal opportunity. Just think about what would it mean, how your world, the world you grew up in, would be, how different it would have been if there had been equal opportunity, rather than some of us, myself included, having gotten a good life through good luck. Good luck, not because the system made it possible, but because my good luck made it possible. Because if the system made it possible, then I wouldn't be much different from anybody else in terms of having a good life. Understand? Just a second. So we're not talking about something that's complicated. We're talking about something that's impossible unless there's a change in the structure of power. Because the thing I mentioned last was a necessary change in the structure of power. You're going to go, all those other structures change. The structure, that's the thing I mentioned last, is what has to come first. And that can only come from the bottom up, because the top doesn't want any changes at all. There was a question over here. Yes.
I was just wondering, when the term underdeveloped country came into common use to indicate people who are not living right?
Would you say that again?
The term underdeveloped country, which is now often modified to be called developing countries.
Or emerging.
Emerging, yes. In other words, they have not come up to our level of being developed and having all the technology. And those are the people we have to work on.
Well, the situation there is very different from here. That is the way in which these basic needs could be met within the rich countries, already industrial countries, could, and I think would require, could be consistent with, and I think would require, ethically, if no other way. And I don't think ethics is a matter of being nice or bad. I think ethics is a matter of survival. Could be done, I would say, only if the rich countries were also taking the proper steps, which are complicated but not at all difficult, to see to it that the poor countries became not rich, but so that their people's needs could also be met. That would take longer, okay? And it's a much more complicated thing because there's so much suppressed and open strife in these countries. And that suppressed and open strife is due to the fact that their societies have been distorted for so long in such awful ways that they've lost their humanity. I understand? We've lost our humanity because we took it away from ourselves, so to speak. But it would be very difficult. It would be easy, for example, let's put it this way, for within 10 years, it would be simple to have everybody who lives in this country to be eating well. When I say eating well, I mean healthily and happily, housed well, educated well. In 10 years, everybody, maximum 10 years. It would take at least 30 or 40 years for that to happen elsewhere because they've got so many steps, high, complicated, difficult steps to climb. One of them is getting a decent government. And that's very, very difficult in many of these countries, not in all of them, but in many of them. It's just simply difficult. In the Congo now, for example, which we're talking about, the scars may never heal. You know, they certainly haven't healed yet. Those are the peoples who are fighting there, the peoples who are fighting in Sudan and Darfur and so on. These are people whose societies were, to use an old-fashioned phrase, rent asunder by the imperialists in ways that never had those people in mind at all. It had themselves in mind, and themselves, what they had in their own minds was, again, to use that word, demented. Just absolutely crazy people, the people who were ruling. The people who went into Mesopotamia and made it Iraq, the British. They didn't give a dog shit about the people in Iraq. The same people went into Persia, which never called itself Iran. Now it does. And so on. It doesn't matter what you're talking about. China, India. I mean, India probably will never recover from having been occupied by the British for so long, and in some sense or another, too fully accepted British standards, which are absolutely crazy standards, which we took and then made them even worse. We're a typical colony. When one country invades another, takes over another, then the one that's taken over usually adapts the worst elements of the country that conquered them. Okay? So
it seems to me that the U.S. is saying that we have to have globalization because we want to help these poor countries industrialize. When we find an industrial company, like an industrialized country, we destroy its industry and put the people back in stage one.
Well, in the first place, you don't want to take seriously anything we say about that. No, but the people who believe that, the people who say it and who in fact believe it, and many of them believe what they say, you know, don't understand their own system, don't want to understand it, and so on. So that when we talk about, for example, CAFTA just passed, okay? CAFTA is a repeat of NAFTA. NAFTA was North American Free Trade Agreement, Canada, U.S., Mexico. When NAFTA was proposed back in the mid-90s and came into being in the late 90s, when it was proposed as a trade agreement. In fact, what it was, always, from its beginning, was a lie. It was an investment agreement, free investment, because we had always had relatively free trade with Mexico. Okay? No problem about that at all. What it was we couldn't invest, we couldn't set up our own factories. Then once NAFTA was passed, we began to get GM, GE, and all these other people where? Pretty much on the border, the maquiladoras, you know. And what that did was, this is the opposite of what NAFTA promised. NAFTA promised raising standards of living in the United States, rising wages, lower prices, did just the opposite. The prices of automobiles actually went up. The prices of the cars that were produced in Mexico went up by 50%. The workforce in the automobile industry went down fantastically, okay? And what went up also was investment. And what happened to the Mexicans was, in the first place, they had been bulldozed, in effect, metaphorically speaking, off their land throughout the 20th century, but especially after World War II. And not only, but particularly by agribusiness from outside. And they had lost their ability to sustain themselves, and they had flocked into the cities. As I think I've mentioned, when I went to Mexico the first time, which was in the 60s, the unemployment rate already in Mexico City was 50%. And it wasn't 50% in the whole country, but it was 50% in the cities. There's no place for these people to go. So when NAFTA came along, what they did was they began to go up to the maquiladoras. The maquiladoras couldn't use them all, so then they began to try to come to this country. And this is not just Mexico, it's all of Central America, and a good deal of Latin America, and so on and so on and so on. Now, as it happens, there is stirring in all of Latin America, no matter where you look, some part, whether Central America, Mexico, South America, one or more, three or four or more of those countries are all beginning to, in effect, turn away from us, whether dramatically, as with Chavez in Venezuela, and with great publicity, or with less publicity, as in Ecuador and Bolivia, for example. But they're turning away from us. However, turning away is not so easy. It's like being a drug addict, involuntary drug addict. That's what these societies are. They've had everything. They've had the normal life of centuries altered and destroyed, poisoned, and there's not much they can do swiftly. So that to try to assist them, in the first place, the cardinal rule has to be, we assist them by their decision in what we do, when we do, how we do it. Nothing else. No bossing. It's assisting. It's yes, okay, we'll do it if you ask us. Nothing. There's poison in our blood. There's poison in the British, French, Italian, German, U.S. blood when it comes to foreigners. You know, it's as though we're having a love affair with them. We think, in fact, what we're doing is raping them. And we don't understand the difference. So there's a long trail. However, things can change more rapidly than we know if you can get a sea change, so to speak, in the major countries. If we could have a substantial, if is a great big, this is an if like this, if we could have a substantial change in the structure of power in the powerful countries, the powerless countries would know that. And they could change more rapidly. They could have some morale, so to speak. I mean, when you look back at Lumumba, Lumumba became who he became. I don't mean also because he was killed. Lumumba became who he became because there was some hope. You understand? in his country. Then he was killed. I don't know how many of you know how he was killed, but it is really a black mark on our history. It's just absolutely, absolutely plain fucking disgraceful. It's a long, long list of disgraces. So the poor countries would take longer. But if we were acting in good faith, that might speed up substantially. Human beings, I believe, have an enormous potential. We have enormous potential for good and evil, for construction and self-destruction in us. One of the things that must happen over the next two or three decades, and that might well happen, is that not only the poorer countries in Latin America, and some of them are not all that poor, in resources they're very rich, in Latin America and so on and so on, not only the poor countries, but the richer countries, as in Europe, have been so harmed, so many of their people now know they've been so harmed by globalization. And globalization itself for the United States has become now destructive, okay, in ways I don't want to talk about now, and so on. So the globalization thing is moving into a series of crises, a series of crises. And what this means is that the Europeans, the Asians, the Latin Americans, the Middle Easterners, everyone is going to have to adjust to these crises. And the best adjustment for all of them is for each to have their own regional economy, a Latin American economy, or it could be a South American, Central American, except that Central America would be much better off attaching itself to South America. A regional economy in which you have a specialization of function, trade within them, and you would also have surpluses. You could also have export-import trade with the rest of the world, but not be ruled by the rest of the world and not be dependent on the rest of the world. It could be literally a trading world of regions. Now, the Europeans, you must have noticed in the past month, both the French and the Dutch said, no, no more. Now, they did that for various reasons, but one of the reasons was that being part of the European Union, which was designed by the United States and was called originally the United States of Europe, the European Union is causing those countries' societies, economies, to become like ours with respect to how people are treated. Okay? And they just don't want that, and they won't put up with it. So the European Union, in my judgment, and this is not a wild judgment, I think it's a cautious judgment, within 10 years it'll be done for, except as perhaps a piece of paper, if that. Now, what has to happen in Europe, if they are to stay well off, is for them to become a regional economy, in which their specialization and function to a large degree, but also self-sustenance in one thing way or another. Now, if they were to do that, and I might say that in Asia, the only question is, how far will China's rule extend? But the larger question, or I should say a question within that, is what about India and China? India has to, and Japan and China, they have to make up their minds, and they know goddamn well they have to make up their minds. Because India has been too close to Britain and too close to the United States. And Japan has been too close to the United States. Now, Japan's biggest customer right now is China. China's biggest customer right now is Japan. And I just don't believe that the Japanese are that stupid that they're going to keep going on with the stupid game of Taiwan that they've been going on, supporting us in Taiwan. They must know that this has such economic threats attached to it for them, and such military threats attached to it for them. So I think Japan is in China's pocket, so to speak. Perhaps a very comfortable pocket, but I think they're... And India has to make up its mind. I think India might well make a stupid decision, which will be very harmful to it. But Southeast Asia, no question about it. Central Asia, who knows? Then that's taking us over toward Eastern Europe. And nobody can say anything, predict anything about Eastern Europe so long as Russia is what Russia is, which is to say, a horrible mess. It is literally mafia capitalism, except it's Russian mafia. It's just absolutely disgraceful situation there. It's semi-totalitarian. Putin is, as you must know, KGB, head of the KGB, which is their CIA. It's right, interesting. Bush, Putin, both presidents, both heads of CIA, you know. And the kind of unrest that's now going on in all those countries with Stan at the end of Kuzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, all these countries are all having tensions with Russia and with the United States. I don't know, have no idea what's going to go on there, but probably some kind of tragedy. But Western Europe, which might very well be able to carve off some of Eastern Europe as part of a regional economy, that's very likely to go. It can't be. I always say to myself, if I have an idea and it's any good, then I'm not the only one that's going to have it. Now, I know that you think, oh, this guy Dowd is just, you know, the genius, but that's not true. If I can think about this, somebody else has thought about it too. Many have thought about it. For example, I'm almost positive that the guy who was once prime minister of Italy and who will be again, perhaps, Prodi. His niece is my cello teacher, incidentally. I'm almost positive that he is saying, in quiet words, union.
How about Spain?
Spain would move into that just like that, sure. And so would Portugal, just like that. And I think so would France, with its funny ways of being very, very independent. Germany, I think, would be forced into...
Maybe,
I think,
maybe in 5 years we'll see it.
Yeah, if we're still alive. If we're still alive. The United States is not going to go down saying, well, hey, it was really fun, wasn't it? Good luck to you. We're not going to do that. We'll kill it. We'll kill everybody in the whole world before we go down. We have to. And you and I have to stop it. Listen, there's a lot, yeah, just a second, there's a lot of unrest in this country now, you know. The unfortunate thing for us is there's no leadership from the Democratic Party at all. And we're such a big country, it's very hard for us to get together as a movement. But there's a lot of unrest, worker unrest, just plain decent people's unrest, decent workers and indecent workers and decent people, about all kinds of things, whether it's war and peace or health or whatever. And the time is not only necessary, it's also ripening. And we just have to take every opportunity we have to try to link arms and work. I think if we don't, we're really going to take a bad, bad, bad turn. Really bad. And I don't think it's a question of 30 years from now. I think it's a question within the next 5 years. And if this process that we're in now with the Bush administration, which is just continuing things that have been going on for decades, if this process is allowed to go through the next election and stay there, I think we're into fascism with the gloves off. With the gloves on, the gloves meaning we all be voter, we can vote for it. In other words, fascism, when it first came into being in Europe, was called by Harold Lasky capitalism with the gloves off. What we're going to get is fascism with the gloves on, because the gloves off meant the getting away of riddance of political democracy. Our country is so bad in this present moment that we can have political democracy with fascism. Okay? We're voting for fascists when we're voting for these people. And the Democrats are now in the position that the opposition to fascism was in Italy and Germany. Sort of. I think there's one thing I'd like to say about what's going on in Brazil, because I think that it's a very difficult thing to be calm and sane about. Namely, Lula is obviously a left person who is, however, pursuing a program which fits in with, what seems to fit in with, globalization. But I think that I've been paying attention to him and it and asking myself, suppose I had gotten elected as he was elected in the situation where my country was heavily indebted to the richer countries and heavily dependent upon them for markets and so on. How would I go from where we are to where I want us to be? What Lula's doing is moving slowly. And he's getting a lot of opposition from people who have supported him because they think he's sold out. Now, I don't know, but I don't think he has sold out. I think he's faced with a quasi-impossible situation. And he's just trying to sort of wiggle his way through it. Now, if he doesn't continue to have popular support for doing that, he's going to get kicked out. And the next person who takes his place is either going to be the old-fashioned guy or a temporary situation of somebody who's waving the red flag but not being able to keep the economy going. I think he's in a dilemma, and this is the sort of thing, this is the great triumph of today's imperialism that makes it almost impossible for people who get freedom for their society, who free themselves to then function well. That's why I'm saying the regional economy is necessary. But that would take a lot of doing, a lot of patience, a lot of popular involvement, much more popular involvement than that which brings about a revolution.
How would it function, say, with Argentina? How would it function in Latin America?
Well, Argentina is moving in the right direction also.
That's why I brought up Argentina.
Oh, sure, Argentina,
so,
Brazil.
So how would it, what do you see it as? How is it going to develop?
It's going to have to develop as the people down there see that. As the people who are in power, who got into power through public support, their supporters and themselves are going to have to be asking, what can we do? And I'm absolutely sure this is going to come to be in their attempts. Whether they'll be able to get away with it or not is another thing again. And I really do think that the future... I mean, although I'm absolutely convinced that there's going to be an environmental disaster if we live long enough, I'm not convinced we're going to live long enough. Because I think the United States, as now constructed, as now governed, if that continues on with, say, Iraq, and there's Iran, and there's North Korea, and there's China, and so on, people who won't bow, I think we'll destroy them. I'll tell you all the thing that always sticks in my mind. Dan Ellsberg, who was on the National Security Council and is a very good friend of mine, and who wrote a book in which he talks about this, Secrets, it's called, says in that book, we were going to use nuclear weapons in Vietnam. Now, that's not just a crime. That's suicide, because China had nuclear weapons. Russia had, the Soviet Union had nuclear weapons. And if one country uses, and India has nuclear weapons, and so on, if one country uses nukes, this is what stopped us from doing it in Cuba. As McNamara himself has said in a book, we were stopped because we thought, if we do it, the Russians will do it. The Russians were stopped because they thought, if they did it, we'll do it. This is when the Cuban Missile Crisis came on. Now the United States is ruled by people who don't think clearly that way. We're ruled by arrogant people now, assholes, literally assholes. They smell like assholes, and they are metaphorically assholes. They're just, or they wouldn't have gone into Iraq. They just wouldn't have done it had they had any sense at all.
You've been listening to one of a series of class lectures on political economy with Dr. Doug Dowd, based on his most recent and as yet unpublished book, The USA, Where We Are and Where We Are Headed. This lecture was recorded in San Francisco earlier this month. Thanks to Michael Slaughter, webmaster of DougDowd.org, for making these recordings available. More information about Dowd's work is also available at that website, www.DougDowd.org. That's DougDowd.org. And you can contact us and download MP3s of this and previous shows at www.unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.